Well, hello everybody. Welcome to this Congress Highlights episode of GUcast. I'm here at ESMO in Madrid. Huge oncology meeting. I haven't been here for years and years. This year they tell us there are about 30,000 delegates at this major oncology meeting. It's not quite as big as the ASCO meeting in the US, but I'm hearing from people here that it might just be a little bit more fun than ASCO. The big advantage of ESMO, of course, is it always happens in a beautiful European city. And here in Madrid, I have to say, it's just a nice place to be for a few days. And boy, have we had some big GU oncology highlights this week at ESMO. Far too many to cover completely in this episode, but we've picked out a few of the things that really caught our eye. We're focusing on some of our favorite topics, of course, including radioligand therapy. I've caught up with a few of the key opinion leaders and key speakers, and I hope that you enjoy our conversation. Here at ESMO, I'm joined by two of the big plenary speakers, Dr. Louise Emmett from St. Vincent's in Sydney and Dr. Oliver Sartor from Mayo. Congratulations to both of you. Louise, you presented the ENZA-P data in the oral here, and Oliver, you've presented the long-awaited PSMA-4 data in the presidential. So congratulations to both of you.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
First, I thought we'd talk about ENZA-P. So for those of us in Australia, we've been involved in, I remember recruiting patients into this study. It was a very exciting study to be involved with and to recruit patients into. And it got a great reaction, I have to say, when it was presented here.
That was great, huh?
It was great, wasn't it?
It's a trial that, it's an investigator-initiated trial. It's got an active comparator arm. And, you know, it was super interesting for me to see whether we really could improve patient outcomes on enzalutamide alone with lutetium PSMA pre-chemotherapy in the mCRPC space.
So the idea was first-line progressive mCRPC, and not just that, but these were bad actors. They were selected out for patients who were likely to progress on enzalutamide. So I remember the PSA doubling time had to be bad. That had some adverse features. Do you want to tell us a bit about how you selected the patients for this study?
Yeah, so in fact, it was based on the PREVAIL trial, so a really lovely trial that was published in the New England Journal that was looking at enzalutamide pre-chemotherapy in the mCRPC space. But when you look a bit closely in the PREVAIL trial, you see there's a significant proportion of men who have primary treatment resistance or early treatment failure with enzalutamide alone. So, you know, we've been using lutetium PSMA as just six doses on its own. And the question was, can we flip that around a little bit and actually use it to knock off treatment resistant clones with another agent to improve responses in patients?
And that was the study design. It was a randomized trial. Everyone's getting enzalutamide, but half these men were also getting six cycles? Four.
No. Two or four, so it was adaptive dosing. So it was only two or four doses, and we used an interim PET to decide whether or not they got two or whether they got four.
Okay.
So about 20% of patients got two, and about 80% of patients got four. And I think that's a really nice way of, you know, treating. This is radiation that we're giving, so we're treating if the target is present, not treating if the target's not present. And I think that's going to be a really nice way to treat as we move it earlier in the hormone-sensitive setting.
So PSA progression-free survival was your primary endpoint. Do you want to tell us the headline?
Yeah, so PSA progression-free survival was very positive. It had a hazard ratio of 0.43, and it was 13 months progression-free survival with the combination arm, enzalutamide plus adaptive dose lutetium PSMA, compared to 7.8 months for enzalutamide alone.
So I might ask your reaction to that, Oliver, as a GU medical oncologist, the rationale for adding lutetium to enzalutamide. Would you be surprised to hear that there might be an additive effect, that there's a benefit?
Not at all. In fact, as I was kind of expecting a nice positive study, there are two different mechanisms here. One is AR-directed, one is PSMA-directed. And I liked her explanation with regard to the clonal heterogeneity and be able to pick off some different types of clones. I think it's a great idea, and I wish I'd been able to do that when we designed the PSMA-4 trial. Yeah. That was our initial proposal, but in fact, the FDA kind of overruled us. So initially, it's going to be a standard of care, sort of like vision, plus or minus the use of the Pluvicto. But I'll simply say that didn't work out that way, but it's okay. We still came up with a positive trial.
And what about the other secondary endpoints then, Louise? You presented your radiographic progression-free survival as well.
We did. So radiographic progression-free survival showed 12 months for the enzalutamide alone arm and 16 months for the combination. It had a hazard ratio of 0.67. We had some problems with RPFS, and in fact, you know, I think this is a little bit because we've got an overlay of a biomarker trial and a therapy trial put together. So a lot of patients had, all patients actually had a PSMA and FDG PET at first progression. And in some of those patients, it was really high volume disease on the PSMA PET. It was very evident. And those patients got taken straight off trial without confirmation of CT and bone scan progression. So we did have some problems with RPFS. The other endpoints were the depth of response, and you know, it was super cool to see that 93% of patients actually had a 50% response rate if you use the combination compared to 68%.
Yeah, is we always talk about surrogate endpoints and how important is PSA versus RPFS. I mean, there are explanations within this trial why the hazard ratio for the RPFS wasn't what it was for the PSA. But are you impressed with PSA as a endpoint?
Oh, PSAs were fantastic. I mean, you know, it was a PSA 90 on the waterfall plot that I really thought was impressive.
They were stunning, those waterfall plots.
You should be able to tell the exact numbers. I can't remember, but it was a whole hell of a lot.
Yeah.
A lot of them.
Yeah.
So that was impressive to me.
Yeah.
One of the things about RPFS, it's still immature data. So we're recutting next year. We still have a significant proportion of patients on the combination arm still on treatment. Haven't progressed yet. So, you know, let's just wait and see.
And you'll report OS at some stage as well.
We're reporting OS and health-related quality of life and lots of other progression or clinical progression PFS and also pain progression PFS as well. So, you know, I think those will also give a story.
And like with all ANZUP trials, this is another ANZUP-sponsored trial from Australia. Lots of translational endpoints to come.
So many translational endpoints. So we've got matched, baseline, day 92, and progression, PSMA PET, FDG, CT, circulating tumor cells, ctDNA, epigenomics. We're going to be doing the whole shebang.
And finally, not powered for OS. Obviously, that's not this study design. But you know, would you expect to see an OS in a different environment, maybe with a bigger study design? This simple strategy, taking out if you only actually follow them with CT bone scan as well, maybe. You know, so I suppose the question flowing on from that, Louise, is do you think there's a place to actually be adding lutetium up front in not a standard of care now, but in a bigger trial design?
Totally do.
Yeah,
absolutely. In a bigger trial. You know, I think it needs a phase 3 trial. In fact, I have really to point out Oliver, he's doing PSM addition.
Yes.
And if you're thinking about where NZP wanted to go, it would be PSMA addition with adaptive dosing in the hormone-sensitive space in combination with ADT and ASI. I absolutely think that's a fantastic trial and super interested in its outcome.
And so we'll look forward to PSMA addition in the future, metastatic hormone-sensitive. But at this Congress, PSMA-4 featured in the presidential session. So lots of excitement in seeing this large trial readout. Do you want to just summarize for us the trial design of PSMA-4, Oliver?
Sure. So I think a lot of people are familiar with Vision. And Vision was standard of care, and that'd be plus or minus lutetium with a RPFS and an OS endpoint. But that was post-docetaxel, or even post-docetaxel cabazitaxel, one or two taxanes allowed, and the ARPIs, which would be abiraterone typically. So the Vision was very late stage. Here we're moving it up. So everybody had to have failed one of the ARPIs, and it didn't matter if it were Abienza or apalutamide or whichever. No chemotherapy. There's a little caveat there because about 3% of the patients actually had pre-chemo in an adjuvant or neoadjuvant setting. It was essentially no prior chemo. And then patients are going to be looked at not in terms of standard of care plus or minus the lutetium, but rather a lutetium in one arm, one-to-one randomization, as compared to an alternative ARPI. So if you started on Abby, then you go to Enza, started Enza, then you go to Abby, RPFS, and then OS, one of the primaries was an OS crossover adjusted analysis, and then a whole slew of secondary endpoints.
Very exciting, and we'll talk about the control arm again in a second, but you want to tell us a bit about the endpoints that you read out at the conference this time around, which got great
reaction. Sure, so the primary endpoint is going to be the RPFS. What we reported here was 12.02 months in the lutetium arm, 5.59 months within the Enza or Abby arm. And then we look at the crossover adjusted overall survival. Hazard ratio was 0.8, but confidence intervals were big. The trial's relatively immature from an overall survival perspective, and so we have a lot that crosses over one.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, we had things like objective response rate, clearly much better, complete remission rate, then by objective criteria, favoring the lutetium. PSA declines, favoring the lutetium. Health-related quality of life, favoring lutetium. SRE, favoring lutetium. And what else do we have? Time to pain progression, favoring lutetium. And adverse events, favoring lutetium. So we had a whole slew of positive, both secondary and exploratory endpoints, all of which favored the lutetium arm.
Yeah, I mean, it's if you're a patient looking at it, it's kind of a no-brainer when you're looking at the adverse event profile and quality of life. Same for your study, Louise, as well. It's almost a given for us at this stage. All the lutetium studies have very, very favorable quality of life profiles. It's fair to say.
You know, the thing that surprised me is the discontinuation rate for the lutetium was only, about 5%. And the discontinuation for the hormones was actually around 15%. People were more likely to discontinue the hormones because of an adverse event as opposed to lutetium. So it is really well tolerated. The, grade 1-2 events, and it's kind of expected. We have a little bit of dry mouth. We did have a little nausea. We do have a little GI upset. But I'll simply say overall, the adverse event profile turned out to be really, really good.
Yeah, and of course, as the trial matures, we'll be watching that OS even adjusted with crossover with interest.
Absolutely. And let me clarify a little bit more, because there is an intent to treat crossover where the hazard ratio is 1.16. That's going the wrong way, not the right way. There were 3 patients who died before they were even randomized, never even got the lutetium. And then, in addition, we still have those big confidence intervals. If you look at the number of deaths on the trial relative to participants, it's about 29%. So we have just a small information fraction at this point. We need more maturity, and I think with more maturity, we'll see things kind of go as expected.
Now, I can see on Twitter straight away, once all this was read out, people are making some comments about the control arm, which is oftentimes the most interesting thing in a randomized trial. And people, I saw Josh Lang, I think his tweet said that, is it really fair to be comparing hazard ratios against an ineffective control arm?
Excuse me, it wasn't ineffective.
The
RPFS was 5.5. I mean, 5.59 months.
And, that's a good point.
You know, that's pushing towards 6 months in the control arm. These patients were selected not to go on chemotherapy. If they were thought to be chemotherapy appropriate, then they went to chemotherapy. So that's one thing. Number two, these patients were continually evaluated, and it was safe for them to proceed. Now, one of the things I did not mention, but I should mention, is the crossover for those who discontinued their RP because of progression. The crossover was in like 76%, so a huge crossover in the trial. So the patients were monitored very carefully. And so from the safety perspective, like, were they on an ineffective therapy too long? The answer was no. I might add that the survival, even though the confidence intervals are big, kind of tracking the same, indicate wasn't any particular harm on being on the control arm. People who needed the docetaxel in the first place would go on docetaxel. And by the way, in the United States, the most common sequence is Abidanza or NZ-Abi, and that's what people do in real practice. So was it an ineffective control arm? I would actually say no. Could it have gone against taxane? Sure. A little different patient population there. But these patients were appropriate to receive a second hormone and actually went 5.5 months before they progressed, which is not too bad.
And then crossed over, actually, they had great options. It's not like they were being denied options. I agree. And it is interesting to note that is a very standard standard of care in the U.S., very common to be flipping from one to the other. And I remember at the start of that whole, which one is 1 plus 1 equals 2 or 1 plus 1 equals a bit? But, you know, it's not ineffective, I think, to say that. And if that's what you can access and if patients are accepting of it, because a lot of patients say, I don't want chemotherapy, I'll happily flip over to the other one even if there's a temporary benefit. So it's a reasonable standard of care in community practice.
It is. And let's talk, briefly about chemotherapy before you die. Now, I don't know what the numbers are in Australia, but in the U.S., it turns out that only about half the patients with prostate cancer who die actually receive a taxane. And if you go to the U.K., it's much lower. And there is a lot of geographic variation here, but I'll simply say that not everybody is taxane either eligible and not everybody is taxane accepting. And by the way, when you get taxanes, they don't always work so well. So, I happen to use a fair amount of taxanes in my practice. I've analyzed my own practice, and about 60% of the patients will get a taxane before they die, but you never get to 100%. You just don't.
So, Louise, what's your take on PSMA-4? Just come forward a little.
Well, look, you know, I think it's really important. We're going to move it forward. So we're going to move a really well-tolerated, effective treatment forward in the paradigm. And I think that's super good. In fact, in Australia, people talk about, you know, you get people who come in really excited after getting lutetium PSMA because they can mow the lawn again. Do you get that a lot? I've never quite understood that, but, you know, that's a really important sign in men. And to be able to get that earlier in the space, to have men live longer, to feel better, that's what we really need. And I think that's what PSMA-4 is helping us do.
It is a consistent thing we do hear from patients, especially as we had that experience with very advanced disease, and my patients would, you know, still be coming back to me saying, Declan, of all the things I had in that past 10 years of metastatic prostate cancer, it was the thing I got towards the end, the lutetium, was the easiest, you know, instead of all the chemo, I had this, that, the other. So I think that's your point, Louise, isn't to be bringing that forward from a patient point of view is obviously going to be a very acceptable strategy.
You know, one of the things that I worry about is, are we using enough dose? You know, if you actually look at the lutetium compared to other therapies, it is so well tolerated at the doses we're using now for the regulatory trials that I question whether or not we ought to be using a little bit more. And one of the things that I like that Louise has talked about for a considerable amount of time is this adaptive dosing. Yeah. You know, we in the regulatory trials are giving it in kind of a sequential every 6 weeks without necessarily regard to the target expression on PSMA PET. You know, I question in my own mind, you know, is that the best way to do it? And I'll simply say that as we're moving a little bit more into the real world, you know, we look more at this adaptive dosing, and I happen to think it's probably a better way to go. But we have to prove it. You know, what I think and what I know and what the regulators know, those are all different things.
Yeah, I'm just going to say about adaptive dosing, I totally agree with you about, are we giving enough dose? And that's dependent on the patient, isn't it? You know, I don't think we've touched the sides in giving enough dose in some patients. And that is adaptive dosing too. There's intensification and there's de-intensification, and I really hope we get there.
But isn't that one of the beautiful potentials of radioligand therapy? We've spoken about it when you've been on GUcast before, both of you, that you can measure dose. You can do a very, if you wanted, very sophisticated, individualized dose the next time for that patient, bearing in mind what target organ dose they might have received, if you're prepared to do very detailed dosimetry on it. But it's probably not pragmatic in real life.
I'm going to counter that. So dosimetry doesn't tell you anything about radiation sensitivity of the clone. And for me, that's the holy grail, is we need to know whether patients have got a radiation resistant or a radiation sensitive clone. That will end up telling us what dose we need to give, how many doses we need to give, whether we need to give it in combination. And that's the puzzle piece we don't have yet.
Fantastic.
I'm going to agree with her because, you know, I think dosimetry has a lot of limitations. I think understanding, like chemotherapy, how much dose you give is just one piece of the equation. How those clones respond, that's totally different. And I think it's probably related to radiation resistance. You know, we know from the work from Australia and others that you don't necessarily have a loss of PSMA expression on the cell surface. You have cells that get a dose and they don't respond. Why is that? How can we intensify? What do we need to add? Or should we go to actinium? Or should we do something totally different? So there are so many questions that arise here. It's an exciting time to be in the field. But, you know, as a little bit of reality check, I do want to say that what we can do on an individual basis and what we can do to convince the regulators are not necessarily one and the same. And I think we have to convince the regulators in the end because they're the ones who will determine access for the patients as a whole and the coverages that patients receive. So I love the little experiments, but I want to do the big experiments, and I want to change the regulators, not just change me.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Oliver and Louise, and congratulations on these great papers, ENZA-P and PSMA-4, at this huge Congress, ESMO Congress. Great to see prostate radioligand therapy so prominent here. So congratulations to you and all your colleagues.
Thank you much.
Here at ESMO, I'm surrounded by urologists. Would you believe it? There's quite a lot of urologists here at this meeting. I was sitting in the last session beside Professor Morgan Rupre from Paris. Hello, Morgan. How are you?
Very good. Thank you.
Nice to see you. And we have Boris Hadashik from Essen, friend of the podcast. You were on a few weeks ago, of course, when you were visiting Melbourne. And Boris has just chaired a really important prostate session. How are you, Boris?
I'm very well. Thank you, Declan, for having me.
And we've also got one of the speakers from the session. It's Christian Gratzky. Christian, how are you? Good to see you.
I'm doing well. Thank you very much for the invitation.
And presented a very important study, Chief Urology from Freiburg. So look, a couple of things we wanted to talk about in this session. The first was Steve Friedland, who we're going to track down for a chat as well. Steve Friedland, urologist from Cedars-Sinai, who has been leading the EMBARK study, which read out in the New England Journal of Medicine last week, which is quite impressive, showing that in patients with biochemical recurrence after local treatment, surgery or radiotherapy, with fast rising PSAs, there was a benefit from having either ADT plus enzalutamide or indeed enzalutamide on its own when compared with ADT on its own. I got that right, didn't I? In preventing metastasis. But that were already read out and was published last week. But at this session, Morgan, we saw him present data about quality of life. And in summary, he showed that adding enzalutamide to ADT did not significantly decrease quality of life for these patients. Well, what are your thoughts, I suppose, on this combination therapy, or indeed ADT at all, in these men with BCR?
Yeah, the real question is to be very pragmatic in our daily practice and how we can we translate that in the prescription for the patient. Because if you look at the guidelines in many situations in prostate cancer, they advocate the fact that you should move on with, I would say, old-fashioned hormonal therapy plus the new generation. And the question that is popping up in the mind of many urologists and should we go for monotherapy? And I think the EMBARK trial is highlighting the fact that there is room probably for monotherapy in these patients. I would be happy to see the opinion of the author of the trial. But from that perspective, I think that the toxicity is something that we should be able as urologists to evaluate very accurately.
I agree, and Boris will come to in a second when he presented the discussion on it, just reminded us that, of course, a lot of BCR patients don't need ADT, right? So that's still a mistake that happens, is PSA is going up a bit a few years after surgery or radiation, going up quite slowly. It's embedded in the EAU guidelines. We understand there's a difference between low-risk BCR and high-risk BCR, so it's just important people understand this is not every patient with a rising PSA should be on any type of hormonal therapy.
Yeah, that's true, and I think that the fact that the new molecular image TEP, PET CT is coming into practice should help us to re-stratify this patient and decide whether or not there is a subgroup that is suitable for both therapies.
Yeah. So, Boris, you did a really nice discussion on this paper, and that was one of the first things you spoke about is, well, of course, nowadays, novel imaging has a role to play in these men with BCR after local therapy with fast-rising PSA. We're talking doubling time of less than a year or thereabouts. Before we talk about the EMBARK study, do you want to give a comment on the role of imaging in BCR as an expert in PSMA PET, having been there from the start?
I mean, certainly, it's easy if the patient has had local radiosurgery already and then you're looking for a new target. I think we have to be cautious if we advocate imaging. We don't want to delay potentially curative salvage radiotherapy to the fossa post-prostatectomy. So sure. There, clear, my recommendation is to do imaging, but if I don't see anything on imaging, I nonetheless advocate salvage radiotherapy to the prostate. So this is something we have to keep in the back on our mind. And the population in the EMBARK study were men that were deemed not to be eligible for another round of local therapy. So these are patients that come to see you and they are concerned about the rising PSA and we don't see metastasis on conventional imaging and they want to do something. And I think now EMBARK shows that we can offer something, and ADT alone is not the gold standard with regards to oncologic outcome. For me personally, the most important fact in EMBARK is that there were treatment holidays. So if you have a good PSA response, you can take the men back on treatment holidays and pause therapy. So and then it opens up opportunities with other of the AR-targeted agents that might have less cognitive impairment. But, I mean, we have to be aware that at least in my country there is no reimbursement for this indication yet, so we will have to wait. But it's an important study. I think not all men need any therapy, so without ADT, it is also possible just waiting until we see meds and then start with the approved drugs. So you have to discuss. There are some toxicities associated, they are handled. bill, you can make a treatment holiday, and it's great that this study has been done, and it's great that it has been presented by Stephen as a urologist. And congratulations on the paper.
Thank you so much.
No, yeah, welcome, it's Steve. So we're joined by Steve Freeland from Cedars-Sinai, and we were just commenting, you presented that New England data at the AUA earlier this year, but great Neil to see the paper. I mean, New England Journal paper on the MFS, so we know there's a benefit from adding ENSA in this setting. And today you presented the quality of life data. So I suppose just an overall, if you talk to mostly a urology audience about which patients you think we should be thinking of a hormonal strategy, and what about the monotherapy question? Is it ENSA alone? Is that going to be good enough if you can get it funded or if you can afford it?
Yeah, so in terms of EMBARK, so this is high-risk biochemical recurrence. High risk is doubling time less than 9 months. It's about a third of biochemical recurrence. If you look at other studies, 30-40%, somewhere in that range. So actually the majority of biochemical recurrence patients have long doubling times. We know from Hopkins, other series, they do really well. They don't need anything.
Just watch them.
Right, just watch them. And eventually, over time, if they're young enough, they may need something. But early on, no. With the high-risk patients, we know they're very high-risk of developing metastasis and dying of their cancer. And so real-world data, not necessarily guidelines, but what's actually happening in the real world is they are getting hormones, and they're getting hormones early. We actually showed some data at the AUA. The median time to hormones in this group was less than 1 year after recurrence. Okay, they are getting hormones. And so the question is, how should we give the hormones? And EMBARK, I think, answers that. It doesn't tell us when. Doesn't tell us if you're getting metastasis-directed therapy, what to do. For the patient, you're not doing metastasis-directed therapy. You want to start hormones because you're worried. EMBARK tells us how to do it, and that is intensified treatment, whether it's ADT plus ENSA or ENSA monotherapy. And so the question is, how do you decide among those two, right?
Yeah,
that's going to be the big question.
Well, and what's the answer? I mean, we had a nice discussion about it today, Boris, but the tempting thing in the abstract was that, okay, while adding in hormone therapy, intensified hormone therapy didn't decrease overall quality of life, what it did do, it was in the sexual domain, there was a hint that perhaps there was some preservation. But Boris said that, you know, maybe he was a bit disappointed with that. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, so first off, EMBARK has tons and tons of data, and we got to keep in mind the top line results were 7 months ago.
Yeah.
So in that time, we've been looking at the primary analysis, the global quality of life. We've gotten two amazing papers out. There's a lot of data to still look at. Okay, that's number one.
OS,
including OS. So that's going to take time, right? That's going to take time to wait and observe. But for the data that we do have, there's a lot to crunch in there. So the other thing to keep in mind is 75% of these patients had had prior surgery. We know surgery affects erectile function. Median age was almost 70 years. These are not necessarily the 50-year-old young, spry, perfect erection patients. There's probably some of those in there, and that's some of the things that we need to look at. In that subset, what does that look like? Not necessarily the overall cohort. Because the overall, you're right, you could argue that it's not as impressive as you'd like, but it is statistically significant, better preservation.
So, yes, I mean, to be a little bit ironically, but now you take care of the PSA, but the patient is unhappy because he has now more sex drive again with the ENSA monotherapy, and he bothers the urologist now to do something about that.
But what we're used to that. We can handle that.
But do you think, I mean, what were your expectations for the patient-reported outcomes in the monotherapy arm? Because there were not really big differences compared to the intensified treatment arm. Do you think the instruments you presented here or the questions that are in these PRO assessments are not subtle enough? So you think there will be more data coming to really drive the benefit of a monotherapy arm, which in clinical practice, I've been treating patients with bicalutamide monotherapy 150, and I think they were doing, I mean, besides some nipple pain, doing quite fine. So what's your, can you comment on the future of the monotherapy?
Yeah, I mean, hindsight's always 20/20, right? So we go back now and look at, I wish we'd included this questionnaire or that. So sexual function is not looked at in terms of the questionnaires we used as closely as we'd like. But the data are the data, it's what we have. So we are starting to tease that out and look at it more. Hopefully we'll be presenting that in the near future, some more detailed look at it. Again, we need to focus on those who had good sexual function to begin with, which is not the case. Most of them did not have great sexual function. But you're right, if you just look at side effect profile, I think our hope was it would be no side effects, there's not castration, everything's great. You do see side effects on par. You do see a lot of less hot flashes. We don't necessarily think a lot about hot flashes, but for some people, it can be very debilitating. So for them, maybe on combination, we could say, look, we could stop the ADT and keep you on monotherapy. So I think you're going to get some conversions back and forth moving forward. But I think the short answer for the viewers out there is stay tuned. A lot more data to come.
And I think my take on that is that, just as we've discussed, your BCR patient, a very large number of them, do not need any form of systemic therapy. And we have to keep punching that message.
100% agree.
Because there's too much ADT used to treat the PSA rather than treat anything else. But I think of those men who are likely to have distant disease, and perhaps they've been through a paradigm of having a PET scan, having salvage therapy, the ones who are left, the ones with those fast-rising PSAs, I think we clearly see now there's a benefit, and we're excited about the prospect of it maybe being monotherapy. That's better than castration on its own, for sure.
Correct. Yeah. And actually, Embark, the entry criteria post-surgery, PSA had to be above 1.
Yeah.
And we chose that because we didn't want to compete with salvage radiation. If you're a candidate for salvage radiation, you should get that.
Yeah.
We'll be here with the systemic therapy when the time is right. If you can be cured with salvage radiation, please do so.
So the other big paper we wanted to discuss is Christian. Let's hand the mic to Christian there, Stephen. So this is big data. I mean, this is a phase 3 randomized trial, again, addressing the question of adding immunotherapy to systemic therapy. And this was for metastatic hormone sensitive. It was KEYNOTE-991, I think, was it?
Correct.
Yeah. So Christian presented KEYNOTE-991. Already there was some press release data showing it had been stopped early. But of course, everyone was interested to see, 1,200 people, what were the final data. So do you want to just summarize for us first what that final data was?
Sure, thanks, Declan. So I guess everybody knows about the previous trials, the phase 3 trials that have been published before in combination on CRPC patients with docetaxel and olaparib, showing negative results. Now we have two studies that were presented here today in the CRPC setting, combining pembro with enzalutamide. And in the trial that I was leading as a PI, it was the combination of pembro with enza in the MHSPC setting. And both trials were negative, and now we have around 5,000 patients in those 4 negative phase 3 trials, and they're all selected on all comers. In our trial, the MHSPC, there was no significant difference when it came to overall survival in RPFS, yet there was a greater prevalence of side effects in the pembro arm. So what we need to do now is to go back to our 5,000 patients and find out who the patients are that did have a clinical benefit from the addition of pembrolizumab to any other drug. Because there are patients that do profit. If you ask Johan de Bono, he will tell you that those patients actually exist. And we have data now. So based on the biomarkers that we know, CDK12, MSI-high, tumor mutational burden, TMB-high, those are the 3 markers that we think have the greatest potential of identifying those patients that might at the end profit from pembrolizumab. And if you add up the numbers, that's a higher rate than BRCA positive patients. So we could potentially have a biomarker-selected population that will benefit from the addition of pembro. So let's see what this outcome will be.
But would it be fair to say, and regular viewers or listeners will know, I'm so super skeptical, always have been, about the role of immunotherapy, all immunotherapy, not just checkpoint inhibitors, in prostate cancer, unselected. And that's what these trials were, unselected.
Yeah.
And I suppose, is that part of the message, is that we should not be doing relatively unselected large trials in metastatic prostate cancer with immunotherapy or combinations? We should be having it biomarker-driven. I don't know, Morgan, we were just chatting to a few other people outside the auditorium here about that as well.
I was sitting in the room next to you, and we had the same the same view. I think it's a message, because we have seen what's happened in the PARP inhibitor story, and if you target the population appropriately based, I would say, on personalized molecular medicine, maybe you can target something. I'm not so sure, as far as I'm concerned, seeing all the negative data that are released, that there is room. But he knows better than me, because I was not investigator in his trial. So if he thinks, and the discussion was saying the same thing, actually, that they should keep moving forward into that direction by sub-selecting the patient, then maybe we can have a smaller population, smaller subset of population who are good candidates.
I agree, Morgan. I think the one thing that I would have to say, I would like to emphasize, is the fact that in the study I was leading, control group did receive enzalutamide as the control drug. And that wasn't available in most countries that we did the study in. So those patients were treated with the best drug that we had to offer at the time. So from an ethical standpoint, I think that was a study. And the addition of Pembro did result in greater side effects, but they were to be handled in a very good way. I'm just saying that to make sure that everyone knows that we did pay a lot of attention to the fact that every patient received the best drug possible at the moment. The addition of Pembro didn't result in any clinical benefit, but that doesn't mean that those patients weren't handled well. Now we have a problem because the patients stay on the drug and the trial was stopped. So we need to ship the enzalutamide to the countries where that isn't available to make sure those patients are still on ENSA until they progress. That's a really important point.
It's a good point because it is a criticism. We see sometimes in pharma-led trials that the control arm is rigged, isn't it?
Right.
You know, you're not getting best standard care, but I agree with your point. They were getting very active, even nowadays, really top first-line care. And you expect some additional side effects, but the disappointment is, there's no OS, to trade it off against. And so have you any comments on that, Boris or Steve, about the future of IO trials? Or can we please just stop doing them is my take on it. Let's do something else.
I mean, the IO trials we've done to date have largely been targeting either CTLA-4 or PD-1, PD-L1. So I think we need to look at other targets. I don't think immunotherapy is dead for prostate. I think it's very exciting, but we just need to figure out other targets.
Yep.
Yeah, I think so too. It's not dead, but we have to be smart, and other combination partners that might have synergy are exciting. So the PRINCE data from Australia are certainly hypothesis generating, and the press release of cabozantinib plus atezolizumab is something that we are waiting for now to see the complete data set, whether there are subgroups to be identified. And so it's not dead, but it remains difficult.
Okay. Yeah. Just add one thing, because I know your standpoint here and you're saying, please stop doing those trials. I just want to remind you that there is, ADCs coming up, there's bispecific antibodies, there's CAR T-cell interest. There's a lot of immune activity drugs that are out there to be tested. And I think I agree with everyone that has said that the selection of the patient, that was Michel Beltran's key message, selection of patients is key. But I think the most important part is the tumor microenvironment, because we know that T-cell infiltration is difficult here. And we have to figure out a way of how to smartly infiltrate the tumor and attack the tumor cells. And we haven't figured out how to do that. But there are other ways to do that. Pembro wasn't the one, we know that now, but there are other ways. So I wouldn't say, and I would ask you to not stop for immunotherapy drugs in general, but do it in a better way and select patients better. That's my take.
And there you go. And there you have a bunch of urologists at one of the world's top medical oncology meetings giving their opinions on immunotherapy for prostate cancer. But great to see urologists here on the podium at ESMO and many other in the audience. Jim Caddo did a fabulous talk yesterday. I saw Daria Tilkey walking by, Bertrand Tombles. There are lots of great urologists who are interested in more advanced disease. And so we love seeing urologists stand up at these conferences leading these trials as well. So more of it from you urologists out there. We want to see you up on these podiums in the future. Thanks very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thanks for having us.
So that's all we have time for on this GUcast, coming to you from ESMO in Madrid. Huge amount of GU oncology here. We can't possibly cover it all in this episode. We will come back and highlight some of the other abstracts that caught our eye in the coming months over GUcast. But for now, that's all we have time for. Thank you for tuning in. Send us your suggestions. Do subscribe and like and rate and all that sort of stuff. And we'll talk to you again soon.